you don't have to search far on social media to find people referring to their cats or dogs as fur babies and themselves as pet parents. But is it good for our pets to treat them like children instead of the animals they are? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're going to tackle that question today on our pet show. We'll also talk about how much dogs understand when we speak to them and new AI-powered tech designed to help our furry friends. And of course, we have experts here for the full hour to answer your questions. Joining me now are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Program Director and Professor of Veterinary Technology, Dr. Jennifer Wells. Welcome back, Dr. Wells.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here again.
Great to have you. MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist, Dr. Emily Ward. Thanks for being here, Dr. Ward.
Thanks for having me again.
And DogAbilities.com owner and trainer, Day Groden. Welcome back, Day. Great to have you.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
The University of Cincinnati is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. And a reminder that the advice you hear on today's program is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit to your own veterinarian. Lots of us talk about our cats and dogs as fur babies. What are your thoughts, Dr. Wells? As a vet, what does it say to you when clients think of their pets as furry children?
This is a great topic because I think as veterinarians, and I hope Dr. Ward would agree with this, I think we do want our pets to get the best care possible. And I think that as we've moved towards this language, I think it imparts a culture where people are thinking of caring for their animals in a more robust fashion. So we're thinking about providing more, entertainment for our pets, with the doggy daycares and all of the different things that we have available now. But from us, from a veterinary perspective, we are also thinking about, increasing the longevity by providing really good health care. And, 20 or 30 years ago, that, we used to have conversations with owners where, they would say literally right to our faces, well, it's just a dog. I'm not going to spend money on that. Or, and I think it's a really positive culture shift in my eyes, because we really want to preserve that human-animal bond where we have that animal living its longest, healthiest life so it can be in the lives with its family for as long as possible. So I think with some few exceptions that we might get to, I think in general it's a positive shift.
What do you think, Dr. Ward? As a veterinary dentist, I would imagine it's really important that people want to give that level of care to their cats and dogs.
I agree. We are learning now in veterinary medicine, that just like in our own bodies, right, the oral system, your mouth, if you have good oral care, then you tend to have good systemic health too as well. And so I think avenues of veterinary medicine that focus more on preventive care, increasing longevity, having a good quality of life going forward, and that's kind of my job, right? That's as a dentist, that's what I do, is I help my patients have a better quality of life. I think that this shift in mindset of how we care for animals in our home and we provide them with health care, enrichment, and those kinds of things has been beneficial to both us as humans and to our companions as well.
Day, how does this translate to dog training? Because I would imagine, and I'm a crazy cat lady, I have self-professed that many times on this show, but I know I have a lot of good friends who love their dogs, but there are points when you're training your dog that you have to treat your dog like a dog, right? I mean, they're looking at you as the leader of the pack and that sort of thing. How does all this, the way we treat our pets and think of them as children, how does that translate when you're talking about dog training?
I agree with Dr. Ward and Dr. Wells both in terms of, I think it can be definitely a positive thing in terms of how we view our pets. We want to keep that human-animal connection and that bond, and training can definitely do that. I think on the same caveat, kind of, at least when I think about my pets and things like that, I just always remember that, I don't want to say that they're not just, furry animals, that are like children. I think of it as, these are my pets, but they also have their own needs, things that are specific to, them as a species in terms of being a dog and things like that. They're going to do dog things, and it's important that we realize that. Same thing with like training, we have to realize that we can't quite treat them exactly like our kids because they're not quite the same. Training principles are very similar to child training and dog training. But I think it's always important that we do have a little bit of that separation in that line, just kind of remembering that, yes, they still are animals. They still are our dogs and things like that. But we can certainly still have that connectivity with them, that bond in training that's very important.
Yeah. Dr. Ward, you were shaking your head vigorously about the training principles. How do those training principles line up with kids and dogs?
Okay, so I have two children. We'll put that out there, right? They are small. I have a 5-year-old and a 15-month-old, and I have two dogs and a cat. And you're right. Like, I think most of us now in training, we're focusing on positive reinforcement, right? Mm-hmm. And that is one of the best ways to elicit a behavioral change, is that we can continue to reward and reinforce behaviors we like seeing by paying attention to them. And these are the exact same things that my children's healthcare professionals have told us as we are learning to be better parents to our kids, as well as if you see your kid doing something you really like them doing, you should be like, I'll say something, I'll be like, Sloan, I really like the way that you played with Julian today. It was really kind of you to share your snack with him. And that's like creates a memory in her head like, hey, that was a good thing for me to do. And you try to ignore the things that you don't want them to be doing, but obviously that aren't, you know, if they're unsafe, you have to do something about it. But you're right, like dogs are different in some ways, but there's a lot of overlap between the two that turns out we're all mammals. We all have a similar neurochemistry and biology, and we're subjected to some of the same forces that help to trigger certain behaviors and other, you know, things that we have to pay attention to.
Interesting. So it's totally different for birds or turtles. I mean,
they use positive reinforcement training for all the animals. Like in the zoo, for example, like how they get all those different species. You give them a positive stimulus, they're more likely to react to that than to a negative stimulus, right?
Ooh, yeah. We're talking about pets for the full hour today, and we have experts here to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU. And if you think of your pet as a baby, your little fur baby, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call and tell us how that works at your house. Is there ever a time, Dr. Wells, when this can cross the line to being bad for pets? I wonder, do animals thrive more when we remember that they're animals instead of, you know, little babies in fursuits sometimes? Is there ever a time when it's a bad thing?
Yeah, I definitely think there are opportunities where that crosses the line. And I think it goes into, you know, the training aspect that we were talking about before, that Day hit the nail on the head. Because in the social hierarchy, in the canine world especially, they do need to have kind of a leader in the household. And in the case of the dog, if there isn't a leader there, if they're being cared for as a child or carried around, and oftentimes they will equate their own status in the household as, you know, the same level as the adults in the household, and sometimes above the level of maybe other children in the house. I'm saying other children, but, you know, the human children in the house. And so that can certainly lead the dog to display aggressive or hoarding, you know, behaviors towards the other members of the household. And it's a common thing I think veterinarians and veterinary behaviorists see with a lot of our toy breeds, because automatically you're holding those dogs more, they're carried around, they're taken in the car. And so, and oftentimes I think with the larger dogs, we tend to say, well, we don't want them jumping, we don't want them, you know, hurting people. So we may take them to behavior training classes a little bit more frequently, which is wonderful, the puppy kindergarten and, you know, level one obedience classes. So they automatically a lot of times get a little bit more training than some of the little pocket dogs do. But yet sometimes those are much more aggressive dogs, in that they're, you know, with their owner and they think that they are, you know, protecting their owner against anybody else who comes in the room. And often that leads to bites and, you know, aggressive type behaviors within that household that make that dog very difficult to live with.
Hmm. Have you encountered that, Day, in terms of clients and that sort of thing?
I've definitely seen some clients that, you know, I would say did a lot of maybe, you know, holding the dog a lot. Had a couple clients who, you know, maybe their pets were sitting at the table, you know.
Like on a chair at the table?
Yes, exactly. Right, yes. Okay. So, and sometimes, you know, I just give some gentle reminders that, you know, they can be on the floor, you know, or, you know, that they are dogs and they don't necessarily need to be there. But as Jennifer says, yeah, it is definitely true that sometimes with our smaller pets, we sometimes maybe cater to them a little bit in terms of wanting to pick them up a lot. Sometimes we do see this with children as well, where they do tend to kind of, you know, pick them up, hold them like a stuffed animal. And sometimes we find that some of those dogs just don't really particularly like that. And sometimes that can cause problems later as well. So I definitely have seen that for sure. And that's where we kind of, you know, I say, like, as a pet parent myself, in a way, is that, you know, I think we can spoil our dogs in a good way, but I think there's also times where we don't spoil them, you know, or we spoil them in a bad way. And I think that's where we see the negative fallout.
Sure, like spoiling to the point you're confusing them, maybe.
Yeah.
Or sending the wrong messages. Dr. Ward, what about things like human food for pets? I mean, I know, you know, Dave was just talking about people who have dogs at their table. I'm going to confess, our cats are rotten. They'll sometimes jump on the table and beg, and I'm constantly putting them down. My husband thinks I'm abusing them by taking them off the table. A little friction there. But, I mean, table scraps can be bad for cats and dogs, right? I mean, there are things that they shouldn't be eating. Talk a little bit about that.
So certainly, you know, I think allowing your pet to have table scraps or things from our, you know, what we consider to be quote unquote human food, right? You know, it depends on what it is. I am guilty of giving my pets things from the table. They are very good at cleaning the kids' plates of what they don't eat at the end of the night. I see that as a service that they provide in my home. There they also clean my floors for me in between vacuuming and mopping. But there are toxicity things, right? Like they shouldn't have chocolate. They shouldn't have avocados. They shouldn't have things that are high in fat or other things like that, because it can spur illness in these guys, right? They can get pancreatitis. Pancreatitis in both cats and dogs can be fatal if it's severe enough, right? So you have to be mindful of what you're giving to them. I mean, I would say the same is true with children, though, too, right? Like, you're not going to give your kid chocolate cake for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and expect them to be the healthiest children you've ever seen in your life, you know? That's why they make dinosaur-shaped chicken nuggets with broccoli added to them to trick your children into eating nutrition. And I think the same is true for our pets, right? Like, we all are trying to do our best of whatever that happens to be. We all have this. I think humans are capable of an enormous amount of love, and I think it's natural for us, you know, to be caregivers in general, just like caring for our families, caring for our pets. It's different, I think, between dog and cat ownership and having children as well. Like, obviously, I'm in both worlds right now, but I don't think that one is superior to the other, or, you know, like, it's not a competition between the people who are prefer pets to people who prefer children, or those of us who prefer both, or people who prefer neither of them, right? Mm-hmm. But I think every family and household has to determine, if you don't want your dog to beg from the table, then you should not feed it from the table, right? It should eat its food from a bowl, whatever it is that you're providing it. Just like if you don't want your children to pester you all the time about certain things, there should be boundaries and limits set to say, nope, we only have dessert after dinner. That's a boundary I had to set in my household.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you have to eat all your food and then you can have some cake or whatever it happens to be. As far as like, what can you feed your pet from the table in general, you know, you have to know what the things are that are toxic to them. And I think many of them, like I said, are familiar to us, chocolates and those kinds of things. And then obviously in moderation on more richer foods that humans are better maybe potentially to eat than that can make our dogs and our cats sick.
Mm-hmm. We did get a question from our colleague, Jen Merritt, here, our colleague at WVXU. Jen says, if we're treating pets like family, do they understand love? Do they know that we love them? What do you think, Dr. Wells?
I think they definitely can sense the same, you know, whether they understand exactly the, you know, the human construct of emotion of love, that may be pushing it. But I think they definitely understand, you know, the comfort and the feeling that comes along with that. I think they're, you know, our pets are looking for the same, you know, comforts in life that we are. You know, they want food, they want shelter, they want warmth, and they want protection. And, you know, their pet parents or their owners are providing those things for them. And I think when they are in a secure environment where all of their, you know, higher priority needs, or, you know, that Maslow's hierarchy, all of those things are being met by their pet parent or their owner, and they're feeling safe and secure and not in fear, I think that provides a sense of wellness that you might attribute to love. So that's my take on it anyway.
Yeah. What do you think, Day?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, especially about the Maslow's law. I think that is really important. But I just think in general, we're understanding that our pets are sentient beings. You know, they all have emotion. Again, they may not have quite the same concept that we have about love or some of these other emotions that we have. But I definitely think that they have an understanding of that comfort, that feeling that makes them feel good. So I think our pets are, we're definitely learning a lot more about them in terms of emotionally.
Yeah. Well, we are going to continue our pet show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about pets for the full hour today, and we have a panel of experts here to answer your questions. My guests are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Program Director and Professor of Veterinary Technology, Dr. Jennifer Wells, MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist, Dr. Emily Ward, and DogAbilities.com owner and trainer, Day Groden. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. And of course, the advice you hear on today's program is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit to your own veterinarian. Let's talk now about how well our pets understand us. Dr. Ward, how well do you think your dogs and cat understand you?
I think when you're talking about basic concepts, I've had them for a decade. So I would say they understand me very well at this point in time because I am a creature of habit, right? All dogs, I think everyone who's ever trained a dog knows that they learn to associate certain words that we say in whatever language you speak with certain actions that should be done or about to happen, right? In my household, it's the stand up and say, okay, and the dogs get really excited because something's probably about to happen. Yeah. Is it snack time? Are we going outside? Whatever it happens to be. You say sit to your dog and your dog sits down. When it comes to more complex, I think, linguistic ability, I haven't seen any academic evidence to suggest that our dogs are secret philosophers or poets while we're away from our home that are looking at, deep linguistic word manipulation to describe their, their existential crises that clearly they're all having while we're not there.
Right.
But I do think that because, dogs have evolved so closely with people over thousands of years to be basically kind of our perfect little companions, they are, as a species, domesticated species, highly attuned to the human condition. I mean, I like to stare into my dog's soft brown eyes and tell him how much I love him. We know from scientific evidence that that type of interaction with your pet does release oxytocin in your brain and your dog's brain, right? That's the love hormone that makes everybody feel good, enhances your bond. So they may not know the exact meaning of an English word or a German word or Spanish or whatever it is, but I do think that many of them at least understand our human sentiment when we communicate with them about things other than commands in the household.
Yeah. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hey, I rescued a blue heeler from a college student, and it really didn't have any room to roam. So when we rescued her, she was pretty much attached to the cage, and probably about a year, she finally decided to venture out. But she grown really attached to my wife, which is natural. But she's gotten better about letting other people talk to my wife and be around her. But when we go to bed, she does not like anybody around her. I just couldn't figure out why she just grown that attachment.
So she's really trying to guard your wife very closely at bedtime in particular?
Yeah, just that time at night. But she's gotten really good, though. I mean, now during the day, she's all right with that. But she also, when a stranger comes around, or actually it's just family member or whatever, she gets pretty aggressive towards them. And she's gotten better, but she didn't even know us from nothing, but she's just real respectful for what we've done for her, I'm assuming.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mark. Day, I'm going to ask you about that. Do you, Day's just like, dang it. Do you have thoughts? I mean, I know there can be a lot going on, but do you have any initial thoughts that might be helpful for Mark?
So I think it is, in terms of the issue with your dog kind of being a little protective over your wife, especially at bedtime, kind of things like that. It's definitely cases that I have seen very similar. And so sometimes when I am kind of seeing that, I think it is important to, you know, set a little bit of a boundary there with your dog. And that could be maybe teaching your dog instead to maybe lay on its own bed, you know, but maybe either beside your bed or outside the bed or be okay in another room or something like that. Just because I kind of feel like, you know, if you're going to bed, your wife is going to bed, you're even coming into bed, that you should be able to do that. That, you know, your dog shouldn't be guarding you or shouldn't be, you know, giving any kind of threatening behavior or anything like that. So it's definitely something teachable that you can teach your dog that, yes, that's not appropriate, but this instead is, you know, that you can be in your own bed and be comfortable, and you don't need to be guarding or anything like that.
Yeah. What about that aggression with other people who come into the house? I mean, I think Mark said that's getting a little better, but is that something that you see a lot with dogs?
That, I will say that's definitely a fairly common issue that does come up. Some dogs, it's, you know, for people who are coming to the house, sometimes they're just alerting that it's somebody brand new, and after a couple minutes, they're okay. Other dogs, it takes quite a long time, or they're not. So some things that I try to do is I try to set up the environment in terms of where I can manage and control where the dog is. So for example, I may not have the dog coming and rushing to the door. Instead, I'll have the dog maybe behind a gate, maybe in another room, kind of something like that. I let the dog settle. I also want to actually have the dog develop a positive association to people coming into the house. So I may give some treats with the dog, I may give him a toy, kind of something like that. And then hopefully over time, as the dog's emotions start to settle better, that they will be at least, you know, can be okay with someone in their home. Maybe not necessarily greeting the people at all, but they can kind of just coexist that someone is also in the house and they're feeling okay about it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of variables there. So sometimes it's better to just manage in general. And then other times, you know, we do want to actually work on the real training piece, kind of things like that.
Yeah. Mark, I hope that's helpful.
Oh yeah. We didn't know her past history when we got her. So that was definitely helpful. I'll keep it all in mind.
Great.
With her tonight. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. Bye bye. One of the things that, in terms of what our pets understand, that I wanted to talk to you about, too, the Washington Post reported last month on new research into how well dogs understand words. You were kind of talking about this, Dr. Ward. In this study that they reported on, dogs responded to words related to play or going outside. This was like the recorded voice of their person on a device. They weren't as likely to respond to words related to food, which surprised me. The researchers said maybe they weren't hungry. Dr. Ward, you talked about the words that your dogs respond to. Day, as a dog trainer, that probably doesn't surprise you a bit, does it? I mean, do you find that dogs really make those associations between words and what you're trying to ask them to do?
I think that they definitely make associations with some words. For example, I mean, I have a lot of clients whose dogs do respond to treat. I mean, they hear the word treat and they come running. I kind of joke about that's their emergency recall. You know, say treat and they come running to you. So I definitely think that. And I think the reason why the dogs do understand the words, at least in that context, is because they understand the behavior with it. That something is happening, they're going to get a treat. Or if we say walk or walkies and your dog enjoys that, then they're going to get excited when they hear that. There's other things that we do as humans too, not just the words, but, you know, they pick up on our body language so much. I mean, we go and we pick up the leash, you know, they kind of know. We pick up a food bowl, you know, they know something's going to happen. And that can go both ways too, whether it's a positive thing or a negative. Good example of that would be something like picking up a nail trimmer. You know, sometimes our dogs go running with that.
My cats sure do.
Yeah. I mean, and dogs sometimes know. Even if we say, you know, well, we're going to the vet, and they might know, and you know, and have a, you know, have a bad feeling with that. So I think that they pick up those words because of what happens after, that consequence, that behavior, because that's how we know how dogs learn, through that association, what makes them feel, you know, in terms of positive and good, and then also through that reward consequence of what happens.
Dr. Wells, what do you think about that language with dogs and also with cats? I mean, I personally believe cats can understand words. My cats are there. Instead of treat, it's cookie, because we call their treats cookies. You say the word cookie, God forbid I want a human cookie, because they go running to where the treats are. What do you think? What kind of words do you think make sense to kind of use with our pets? What do you think they understand?
I certainly agree with what both Dr. Ward and what Day have already said. I think it's definitely based on, you know, the positive reinforcement of, you know, just over, you know, months and years of us using those words, that our dogs are picking up on what happens kind of right with that word or right after the word, you know. So if they see us going to the refrigerator and getting a treat, or going to the cabinet and getting their cookie out or a bone or going for a walk, they are just associating those things that happen every single time we do that, or what our body language is when we say that word. And it just, you know, reinforces that every time that word happens or that sound happens, that that's what's going to, you know, come out of, you know, that behavior. So, I don't think they understand the language, which was kind of what the researchers were talking about, but they definitely do start to recognize that sound pattern and understand what should be coming next, which if they like that, then they're going to be excited about it. Cats, as you have said, are a completely different story. I bond with you over the cat, crazy cat person. So I think cats do somewhat understand what we're saying in the same concept that we're talking about with dogs. But I find myself, bowing down to the cat coming to ask me for things, right? So, you know, they come to me and meow, and I look at the clock and I go, well, yeah, it is about time for you to have your treat, instead of like, you know, the dog is coming to me, or I'm coming to the dog and saying, hey, would you like your cookie after you went outside or something? So I think it's a little bit different. I mean, there are certainly well-trained cats out there, and, you know, all of our behaviorists and trainers will tell you, you obviously can train your cat to do tricks and do things on command, especially those food-motivated cats that will do things for treats. But I think that they tend to many times rule the household. And so they're usually coming to us when they want something, or very much picking up on those, you know, timely cues. Like, you know, if they're fed at, you know, 4:35 in the afternoon one day, they better be fed at 4:35 in the afternoon every day from there out, or, you know, there's going to be a problem, right? They're going to be hunt you down.
Yeah. I didn't know cats could tell time, but I think
they have somehow amazing internal timepieces. So, yeah.
You know, Dr. Wells just mentioned food-motivated cats and dogs. The fact that these dogs didn't respond to food-related words in this study really surprised me. I mean, those are the words my cats seem to know the best. How much of communicating with your pet varies from pet to pet, depending on their motivation? If they're food-motivated, or some really like to go outside, or maybe some really like to snuggle. I mean, does it vary a lot depending on what motivates your particular pet?
I think so. And I think it goes back to how we talked earlier about how we're learning more about that dogs are, they're sentient beings they have complex emotional internal lives that we are not aware of, right? And just like humans, each one of them is its own individual, right? We can have some behavioral expectations based on breed for some dogs, and maybe for some cats too as well. But each one is its own unique set of whatever, right? My two dogs and my cat are all three of them are motivated by very different things. You know, the greyhound wants to go outside and chase stuff. So like anything relating to outside words or going for a walk, that's really what will get her lazy bones up out of the bed, because they're the world's fastest couch potatoes, right? Greyhounds don't do anything unless it's time to go running. The little dog wants to do anything that involves snuggling on the couch and having snacks from, you know, my snacks, basically. So if he sees me going to get myself a little treat from the pantry, you know, he'll come out of wherever he is, because he's like, oh, it's cheese time, you know. My cat is incredibly food motivated. So if he hears the crinkle of any kind of bag of some kind, suddenly the cat appears out of, you know, what seems like nowhere most of the time. And I communicate with them all differently. You know, I use different words with them when I speak to them. I use a different sounding baby voice when I talk to each one of them. They each have their own preferred places where they get pets from me, you know, and so I think if we're talking about like, how do we communicate with them differently? Do we use different words with different pets? I think, yes, the answer is just like a human being, we talk to them as they are individuals, just like we talk to individual humans.
Yeah. We do have another caller on the line. Hi, Judy. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
My question is, I have a golden doodle who is now 4.5 years old. We got her during COVID, and she never saw many visitors because we didn't have any. And now when people come to the door and come into the house, she barks incessantly. And she doesn't stop barking until they leave. Is there anything we can do about this now?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a tricky problem with your pandemic puppy there. Day, I hate to bug you again, but as our resident dog trainer, do you have thoughts about that?
So that's definitely a common issue, and we have seen that with some of our COVID dogs. And, you know, now they're, you know, 3 to 4 years old, and they kind of, I would say, missed maybe a little bit of that primary socialization. But there are definitely ways to work on that. I'm really big about when we have people at the door or dogs who are showing, you know, quite a behavior that we don't necessarily like, but I'm really big about working on the emotional piece with the dog, meaning that I want to, like, when guests come to the door, dogs are very aroused, you know, whether it's excitement or whether they're alerting us that someone is there, we have that arousal factor. So what I like to do is try to lower that arousal first, because when you lower that arousal first, once you have that, then you can ask for XYZ behavior with the dog. But if you try to do that in that emotional state where they are just really ramped up, you're probably not going to get anywhere. So kind of like what I talked about with the other guest with his blue heeler, that I do think it's important, like, you know, where is your dog when people come? You know, is your dog right at the door? I would have them, you know, be further away from the door, so there's some distance there. I like to try to condition that response that people come, you get something good. You get treats, you get toys, whatever it is that the dog particularly likes, in a sense. Once I have that, and I make it very predictable, so every time someone comes to the door, I might be just dropping treats and having them, you know, look for those, eating those. Then once I have that, then I can ask for a behavior. It could be a sit, it could be a down, it could be a go to bed, kind of things like that. The other important piece that I think is really important that I think a lot of people don't tend to work on is actually working on this particular behavior when your dog isn't so aroused. So, like, maybe have a person that your dog knows come to the door and you practice this, versus having someone who's a complete stranger at the door and then trying to do this. Because when we practice some of these behaviors out of the context and we're teaching the dog what we want them to do, then we can actually put it back into the context of that particular problematic behavior, and the dog is going to be more likely to do that.
I hope that helps, Judy.
Problem, it's somewhat, but the problem is that even when my dog knows someone very well, like my best friend, she'll still continue to bark. We're the only ones, my husband and myself.
Yeah. Sounds like maybe you could practice with one of you leaving the house and coming in. Is that part of what you're saying there, Day, if it's either the husband, Judy, or her husband?
Yeah, you could definitely start there. There's no reason why not to start with that. And maybe instead of having your someone that she does know being right at the door, maybe the person is further away from the door, in a sense, so that you don't have quite as much arousal factor there.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Judy. Best of luck with your puppy. I hope that all works out better for you. We did also have an email from Elizabeth. Email writes, "Hello, thanks for doing the show today. I have a beautiful rescue named Ebony. She is 3 years old. She's a rescue I adopted from the Stray Animal Adoption Program as a pit bull and German Shepherd mix. People are often reserved around her, especially certain behaviors she has, like leash reactivity. She's very sweet and non-aggressive, but she does struggle with leash reactivity, especially when seeing another dog. What causes this in dogs? Any suggestions on how to help reduce that? I'm going to give you a break, Day. I don't know. Dr. Wells, do you have any thoughts about leash reactivity, what causes it?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give Day a break, but we'll circle right back because I'm sure she has some thoughts. But I have a leash reactive dog, so I'll be happy to share. He's awesome. He was not well socialized because he came out of the shelter, probably similar scenario to her rescue dog. And we go on a leash, and whenever he sees anything out of the ordinary, this could be anyone walking down the street, especially a child lower than shoulder height, or an open garage door, or any other human, he will completely, I call it floofing, but you know, he pilo erects, his whole back goes up. He looks like a ridgeback. And he's a 90-pound Labrador, so he's a big boy. And so, you know, most of the time Labradors, Goldens, you know, they tend to be very outgoing dogs, and they want it, you know, people are like, oh, you have a Labrador, let me come and pet him. And I'm like, no, he really is not comfortable meeting you. And so I think most of the time, my perspective and the research that I've done with him and talking to other trainers is that it's coming probably from an area of discomfort and, you know, somewhat fear of the unknown, or, you know, just not unsure or being unsure of what's going to happen. Sometimes it's a lack of socialization, which was what we were just talking about with our previous caller, where they are unsure of what the other dog is going to do. Maybe they've had a negative interaction previously with dogs on leashes, or maybe like my dog has been attacked a couple of times in the neighborhood by dogs that are loose and they come up to him too abruptly. And, you know, that's very scary for a dog. And so it's definitely possible to work through some of those behaviors, give your dog some more confidence on the leash, confidence in you as the leader at the other end of the leash. That can be done through training and, you know, conditioning, which was some of the behaviors we were talking about with the dogs that were reactive inside the house just a few minutes ago. But it can be very difficult to work with when you're kind of walking down a street and you never know what's going to be around the next corner. So that's my take on it. There definitely are a lot of things that you could work with a trainer on and how to deal with that reactivity. But those dogs may always be difficult to handle depending on, you know, the other dog coming at them. Because it might be my reactive dog on the other leash that your dog is reacting to. So that's my take on it.
Yeah. Day, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, leash reactivity is definitely a pretty common issue as well. And as Dr. Wells alluded to, it can definitely be fear-related or discomfort. We also see a lot of dogs who are leash reactive who are frustrated. That's a big one, especially for some dogs who do want to actually meet the dog. That would be where frustration will come in. Sometimes we see that with some of our daycare dogs who go to daycare a lot because they're, you know, they're used to meeting dogs all the time. One thing I would say to the email person is that I always say when I'm working with leash reactive dogs, distance is your best friend. There's always a point where your dog isn't going to react. Now, it may be 100 yards away, but that's your starting point. And that's the point that you want the dog to be able to actually just look at that stimulus, that dog, that person, whatever it may be, and that they're not going to react. So again, I'm going to use something that is motivating for the dog, whether it's food, treat, maybe it's moving away, you know, that space, that type of thing. And then over time, as the dog gets better with that, then I can lessen that distance, okay? Because a lot of times with just walking, you know, it's not a long period of time. You know, you just have to be able to pass the dog, the person, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But through repetition, you really can help your dog get better with that. There's, you know, quite a few other little techniques and things that we do teach the dog, and that's where a trainer would definitely be helpful there. But that's kind of just a general answer for that.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I would just chime back in with my dog. It definitely helps for me if we're approaching another dog. I just move my dog off the sidewalk and make him sit and look at me. And if I've got my treats with me, you know, I keep him engaged that way. And then that lets that other dog pass by and keeps my dog, you know, less anxious and less engaged with the other dog. And then we just move on. So that kind of helps lower his arousal level. So.
Yeah. Well, we will be back after a short break to wrap up today's pet show. If you have questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our pet show. My guests are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Program Director and Professor of Veterinary Technology, Dr. Jennifer Wells, MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist, Dr. Emily Ward, and DogAbilities.com owner and trainer, Dave Groden. They're here to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. And keep in mind, the advice you hear is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit to your own veterinarian. Let's talk a little bit about artificial intelligence and how it's being used in technology for our pets. There's now a robot companion that can be a nanny for your dog. It can play fetch with your dog, can play soothing music. Dr. Ward, what do you think of that? Is that good? Is that bad? Neither? What do you think?
I think it's yet to be decided, right? I think most of us have to work in this economy in this day and age, right? So like we have to leave the house at some point in time and go to spaces in which our pets are not allowed to be there. Also, I would find it very difficult to do my job if my pets are there. My dog has been in and out of the hospital recently for orthopedic issues and she's been with me and it's more challenging to have them around, right? So I think that we're trying to come up with ways to provide our pets with the things we want them to have while they're sitting around inside of our home spaces while we aren't there for multiple hours per day. Dogs are social creatures, especially if you have only one dog or you're a single person, and the only interaction that dog gets during the day is with you when you are home and you're gone 10 hours plus a day, right? I think we're trying to come up with solutions for that. Is having a nanny robot that does things for your dog a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. It's probably not a substitute yet for actual human companionship. Like I said before, dogs have basically evolved with us to be like our perfect little companions. Like they're very social creatures. They probably need some level of human interaction. That's what they're designed for. Can a robot replace that? I think the jury's still out on that one.
Yeah. Okay. We got a call from Sarah. Sarah couldn't stay on the line, but Sarah has a shelter cat, was in the shelter for 5 years. She's had her cat now for 2 years, and she's worried her cat is lonely. What do they think about having one cat versus two? Could the cat be lonely? He didn't really interact with other cats in the shelter. Dr. Wells, I'm going to throw this to you as a fellow crazy cat lady, because this, yeah, I think, is a very controversial topic. I've volunteered at shelters. They always encourage you to take at least two at a time. I think there are a lot of motivations there. I've got one cat who I think would be very happy as an only cat. Unfortunately, she's a middle child, so it's too bad for her. What do you think? How do you gauge whether your cat needs a buddy or not?
Well, I think cats do need some social support, and whether they're getting that from their human companion or from another companion in the household, whether it's a cat or another pet. I've seen some dogs and cats actually be very good companions before, but in this case, we're assuming that this cat is all alone in the house. So maybe we go back to what we were just talking about. You know, is this owner away for 12 or 14 hours a day? If that's the case, you know, then maybe need to look at whether the cat is, you know, overly anxious when that owner gets home, or maybe there's ways that we can look in on that cat while the owner is gone. Are they vocalizing or showing signs of distress while the owner is gone? Maybe showing signs of some separation anxiety or something that is letting the owner know that, you know, they're not comfortable when they are alone for a long period of time. That would lead us into exploring options to give that cat some more enrichment if they are experiencing some anxiety. Now, if this person is not gone for 12 or 14 hours a day and the cat is very comfortable and, you know, there's no, signs of distress, I think a lot of cats are really super happy living solitary lives. If you think about most of the cat world, they pretty much come together to raise their kids and maybe hunt and pretty much, you know, live pretty solitary or would be happy living solitary lives on their own. So I think a lot of cats do just fine alone. I absolutely agree with many of our shelters that it's great to adopt two at a time because, you know, they do tend to bond if you bring them into the household together at the same time. But we do also sometimes run into some behavioral issues if we have a cat that has established this household and we bring in another cat. They may or may not decide to be best friends, and that can present some other issues in the house. So, you know, you may be trading one perceived problem for another problem that could be a real problem down the road.
Do you have anything you want to add to that, Dr. Ward? As somebody who has a cat and two dogs, is your cat a good buddy with either of your dogs?
I think all of my animals like to keep their distance from each other and would all prefer that all the other animals and children in that household never came home again and it was just the lady who provides the food at the end of the day. But they all get along very well. And I think there was an opportunity for me to bring home another cat recently, and I really liked this cat a lot, but I have such a good thing going in my house right now that I decided against it because I didn't want to rock the boat, right? The house is very calm and very less chaos.
That is saying a lot with the little kids you have. The fact that you can say those words, I tip my invisible hat to you.
I don't think it's any special skill that I have. I think it's just the creatures I happen to have been fortunate enough to inhabit my space with. It has nothing to do with any skills on my part at all whatsoever. But I think cats are social, just like dogs are social. And you're right. If the animal at home, when you're away during the day, if you had like a nanny cam on it or something like that, and you were seeing that the animal seemed anxious, or in the case of dogs, when they're left alone, some dogs will find things to do that you don't want them to do when they are bored. You know, this is one reason I have a greyhound, because when they get bored, they just go back to sleep for another 20 hours. Like, this is a great dog for me. So I think it depends on the pet that you have, right? Is your pet lonely? It depends on that pet. And I think if the pet is wandering around the house crying and is upset as, you know, when you leave, or they're waking up during the day and they're getting into trouble when you're not there because they need some more stimulus, a little friend might be helpful. Usually in those cases, when I was in general practice, I recommended that you went through like a foster organization, because then someone's had that pet like in their home. They understand its behaviors, how it does interact with others. And there's that sort of like trial period chance where you can take it into your home, see if this pet can be integrated with you. Because just like humans, sometimes we integrate well with the other humans we need to be around all of the time. And then we all know those people in our lives who we've had to encounter and spend time with in a school setting or a work setting or whatever, where there's going to be friction, and at least we get to leave at the end of the day. But if you're stuck with that other person for forever, that could create a problem that is new, and it wasn't loneliness anymore. Now you have this whole other set of behavioral issues on your hands.
Yeah. I know the shelter where I used to volunteer, they would say, hey, if you have a dog that you want to bring in to kind of meet the other dogs, or even take the dog into the cat room to see if the dog creaks out. But they never recommended that with cats. It was never bring your cat in from your home and address, you know, introduce
it's it never going
to
go well.
No, that is not no. A story that will end well. Well, I hope that Sarah figures out whether her shelter cat really does need a buddy or not. Well, this has been lots of fun. I wish we could talk for another whole hour, but probably I'd get in trouble because there's fresh air on after this and stuff at night. So thank you all for being here. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Program Director and Professor of Veterinary Technology, Dr. Jennifer Wells, MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist, Dr. Emily Ward, and DogAbilities.com owner and trainer, Day Groden. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. My cat is Funky Winkerbean. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.